is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday. Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud. Well, you hear the remarks there from President Trump leaving a rally in Minnesota, hearing for the first time the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And this was news that everybody knew would be coming at some point, but of course it's always a shock. And here at election time, it raises a lot of questions, to say the least here, huh? Ginsburg was 87 years old, and she died from complications surrounding pancreatic cancer. Of course, the political stakes have just risen tremendously with election 2020. Bring on Michael Johns to start the program and discuss this death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Michael, the timing of this is, not that the timing is ever good for somebody this stature. The president put out a tweet. He said, "We were put in this position of power and importance to make decisions for the people who so proudly elected us, the most important of which has long been considered to be the selection of the United States Supreme Court justices. We have this obligation without delay." Now, that was the tweet, Michael, that everybody was questioning, how would the president go on this? And of course, we'll get into that more with the left and the right. But what's your reaction to the death of the justice?
Multiple reactions. I mean, number one, in this contentious political environment, I don't think there's going to be any Supreme Court opening or nomination that's not going to be filled with a lot of controversy and on both sides. I mean, and part of that is the fact that the federal courts, which used to simply serve the role of interpreting the rule of law, which is their functional and constitutionally granted authority, have become so increasingly activist. And Ginsburg, some words of praise for her career. I mean, 40 years in very high level positions, both in the federal district court and then ultimately through the Clinton appointment in 1993 on the Supreme Court, was, you know, the most far left justice on the court. Now, you're going to hear Merrick Garland cited many times from 2016 mm-hmm. when the Senate did not act on that nomination mm-hmm. by Obama. Mm-hmm. Huge difference from this time. Republicans controlled the Senate in 2016. And trust me, if the roles were reversed, the Democrats would be moving forward with this. A final quick point is that there were, by my math, just in the 20th century alone, six historical examples, the most recent being Anthony Kennedy, who were nominated in election years and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. So this idea that there's something line with historical precedent is inaccurate. The president needs to make a prompt nomination, and this Senate needs to hopefully get behind that nominee and get him on the court.
The question that's being posed by many is, well, what would Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer do if it was on the other foot? And clearly everybody can answer that and know they would promptly move forward. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says, and I quote, "We'll receive a vote on the floor of the United States Senate." Speaking of that empty seat now, he says the Senate and the nation mourn the sudden passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the conclusion of her extraordinary American life. And he gets into exactly some of the things you were talking about, Michael, about the midterm election before Justice Scalia's death in 2016 and the Republican Senate majority and how things have changed with the parties. But, you know, a lot of this has changed because, again, the Democrats changed the rules on this. You never could put a justice forward at one time with 51 votes. You'd need a supermajority of 60. But that all changed, didn't it?
Yeah, you get two different governing ideologies here. I mean, one in conservatives and Republicans, which sort of looks to what does the Constitution sort of provide and account for. And that certainly accounts for the president to make a nomination in this opening. And then their rules, which sort of, you know, like this Biden rule, which was convenient at the moment on not making a nomination a year before an election. And whatever Biden has to say about all this, you know, one of the questions that has to be put right back at him is where's his list of potential nominees? Yeah. When Trump was at this point in his race in 2016, he had put out and had consulted with the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society to put out a very compelling list saying, this is the list we will work from should we be given the opportunity to make a Supreme Court appointment. And that list was scrutinized by the American voters and many.
And he just added to it again.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is there's no like, I think we have a very transparent president to his credit. I mean, he's very out there saying, right, here's what I'm going to do. We're being asked now to make to vote potentially on a Democrat nominee with no idea of who he's actually going to put forward. Now, I'll suggest it's going to be a very radical left nominees. That's why we're not seeing. That's why we're not seeing that.
Probably,
list. The list exists.
You know? I have heard. I've heard rumblings that he's going to come out with a list soon. So we'll see. I don't know. The impact is understated to what this election will be. How does this change the election dynamic right now as things are really heating up? How does it change it?
I guess the most substantial thing is it's going to be a reminder to the American people about the importance of the election. So for those who want to see a Supreme Court that adheres to the Constitution and interpreting the rule of law, it's going to incentivize them to get out and vote. To those who want to see, who on the left see the Constitution as just a meaning, you know, essentially a meaningless document, and see the courts as a super parliament that basically renders final verdict based on the whims of the people that are on it, it's going to incentivize those people to get out to vote. I don't think net that it's a positive for Trump or for Biden. I think the anticipation of most Trump supporters is that he would act on this. I don't think he would gain any. And that's the other thing. We never get any political benefit from compromise on many of these issues. So in the most pragmatic case, if he had said, yeah, you know, we're 6 weeks away from election, let's see what happens, I don't think he'd gain. I don't think one singular vote would come his way as a result of it. Yeah. On a political basis, I don't think that there's any benefit or detriment to the decision they've made. He's just doing the right thing.
We are definitely in a politically divided country, for sure, and everybody knows that. But one thing for sure is this puts a lot more stress on the system. And I think that's what people are mostly concerned with now, is how do people react to this? And, you know, everybody's got a different point of view, but it certainly adds more fuel to the fire as far as what will happen, not only before the election and at the election, but after the election. How does this impact all that? We can only guess. We don't really know, my fellow Americans, so we shall see. Michael Johns, as you know, will be back with me a little bit later in the program. We'll do that whole second hour. We will jump more into Ginsburg at that point and talk more about some of the ramifications of this major death that has happened at, you know, some people would say very untimely moment, and others would argue that point, of course. And let me bring on Dr. Carol Swain. Dr. Carol Swain is an award-winning political scientist, a former professor of political science and professor of law at Vanderbilt University, author of 8 books, and host of Be the People here on America Out Loud. And Carol, the death of the Supreme Court justice, the timing on this is a bit surreal. I mean, if you could, you know, one more thing that could possibly happen in this election season, and here we are. Who could have predicted this? What are your thoughts on this moment?
Justice Ginsburg, she's been at death's door many times before, but she's always pulled through. And the timing couldn't have been worse, in the sense that the political left is already up in arms. And so we can imagine that with so much at stake, the appointment of a new Supreme Court justice that clearly would tip the balance if that justice is conservative. I'm sure it is something that we can expect the war between conservatives and liberals to intensify.
Your gut feeling, do you think they tend to move forward before the election, or do you think they put off? What do you think they're inclined to do?
Well, I think with the president being Republican, the Senate being majority Republican, there would be a precedent for them to move forward. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the McConnell rule that he put in place after Scalia died, it's a totally different context. And as far as I'm concerned, Scalia died under suspicious circumstances. There were lots of reasons why you would not have wanted Obama to fill that vacancy. In this particular case, with a Republican president and a Republican majority Senate, I believe it would be a mistake for them not to move forward. If they do move forward, we can expect an all-out war with the media and the Democrats. But we've been accustomed to that. Whenever conservatives act conservative and try to protect our traditional values and principles, it generates an all-out war.
Well, we can probably expect there's going to be some fireworks with this for sure. And we'll be talking a lot more about it in the days and weeks ahead here, no doubt. Let's move along and talk about two interesting town halls this past week here. Very fascinating. And so you had one with Joe Biden, who was in a CNN one, and Donald Trump was in an ABC town hall. Quite a bit different. And many of the headlines were different as well. But here's one of the most interesting, shocking statements, Carol, that was said. If the president had done his job from the beginning, all the people would still be alive. Now, this is shocking that he said this. I mean, he said all the people. He said, I'm not making this up. Just look at the data. Look at the data. So what do you think of that statement?
Well, when I hear Joe Biden make outrageous statements like that, it makes me chuckle because he talks about the data, and the Democrats love to talk about the science, except they don't follow data and science or even truth. And we know that he was the one that criticized President Trump when Trump made the decision to stop flights coming from China. He called him a xenophobe. And so he was leading the criticisms against the president when the president took proactive steps to protect the American people. And during that town hall meeting, Joe Biden stated lie after lie after lie with very little pushback from Anderson Cooper.
Well, would you be surprised if I tell you that the media does not agree with you, Carol?
No, I wouldn't be surprised at all because the media works for the Democratic Party. And we know that CNN, its nickname is the Communist News Network.
Well, here's these three headlines, Carol, that listen to this just gives you a quick sampling here. Bloomberg says Biden aced the town hall. Why didn't Trump? CNN says Biden shows the qualities Trump lacks at CNN town hall. And USA Today, Donald Trump's supervillain ABC town hall made Joe Biden appear almost superhuman. Just a sampling of some wild headlines. And I mean, this whole narrative is the media is clearly in the tank for Biden. I mean, the proof is right there, right?
Well, they have to do that in the sense, now they don't have to lie. They don't have to be so partisan, but they have a dog in the fight. And they realize that they have someone that isn't capable of representing himself very well. And so they have set it up as cushy as possible for him to have softball questions, to get away with outlandish statements, and to not be challenged for his own record. And so we have pretty much 50 years of Joe Biden and failed public policies, outrageous racist statements, and they never hold him accountable.
Oh, isn't that the truth? We've seen that time and time again. But this statement, I've never quite seen anything like this, where the candidate actually comes out and says the president, you know, blames all the deaths on the president is really unbelievable. But that should tell everybody where this race is headed. And we're only in the early start of this thing. Remember, this thing just got fired up. So,
but I have to tell you, Malcolm, that I see Democrats do that all the time, that they just tell, I think the expression is bald-faced lies. They look you in the eye and they just lie, lie, lie. And the people who support them that want to believe the best of their candidates, they believe it. But to believe what they're saying, you have to have suspended any critical reasoning and thought. And you have to live in a bubble and you just want to believe so much. You have to want to believe, because if you applied any type of rigorous review of the statements or gathered any data, and you would know that you are being treated as if you're a fool.
Yeah, I mean, the narrative and the common denominator of all these stories you're going to find out today is the media and the lack of them doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. I mean, we're going to see that more than we've ever seen in the next couple of months. If you think it's been bad before, watch what's going to happen, I promise you all, over the next 60 days. Well, let me move on and tell you about this other story, Carol. Interesting. Joe Biden says he would mandate mask use on federal property. And let me read you his quote here. It's interesting. So he says, I would make sure that I would call every governor in the country into the White House and say, you should be putting mandates out. But, and if they don't, I'd call the mayors in their towns and their cities and say, put out mandates. But I will do this on federal property. As president, I will do that. On federal land, I have the authority. So he is pumping up really the fear factor and suggesting that everybody's going to be put in mask again. How can this be a positive thing for the election?
Well, it might seem positive to Democrats that are scared, that listen to CNN and the media that play up the COVID numbers and deaths. And so if you are afraid and you live in fear, and you believe those masks are actually protecting you from a disease that's going to kill you and all of your family, that might be good news. But for the rest of the world, those of us that have been out living our lives, that's bad news, because some of us only wear masks when we have to, and we've been perfectly healthy. I know that any of us could contract a disease tomorrow, but the people that I know, and many of them are Christians, they're not living in fear. They're not hiding behind masks. They're going about their lives. And so that's bad news for people that love freedom and liberty and who really do know the science.
Yeah, I mean, we've been reporting on these masks thing. Many people, they're very controversial, to say the least. It does go against our constitutional rights. And the other problem is many doctors suggest they do not work. They're not effective. But beyond that, the numbers are really twisted in this whole thing. Let's talk about that a little bit more and bring it right to the center of Nashville. Now, to tell listeners now, this is your hometown. You're from Nashville. And actually ran for Nashville mayor as well. So you're very familiar with the politics there in Nashville. And this story here that we'll talk about next has major implications, because if you think it's happening in Nashville, well, let me tell you, it seems to be happening in a lot of areas as well. There's claims of New Jersey this happening in other states and cities. But here's the deal on this. This is quite striking. Now, this story is truly amazing. And what they've done is the mayor's office, now emails have surfaced that indicate the mayor's office has downplayed. Now, they have Nashville locked up tight as a drum, from what I understand, Carol. People are hurting. Businesses are not open. There's nothing happening. They're going out of business like they are everywhere in our nation. But some emails surfaced that shows that the deaths, or the cases even, just the cases, were so minuscule, it wouldn't impact anything. And yet the mayor's office hid all this information from the public. I believe it was reported in Bars and Restaurants reported just 22 cases, which is stunning. And these emails suggest that. What is behind this whole story, do you think? And how big of a story? And will this impact that Mayor Cooper out there?
Well, first of all, I would say that the city is partially open, but we have a mask mandate where if you're caught in public without a mask, you could be fined. I'm not sure exactly what the fine is. And because the police officers are not willing to issue these citations, the mayor has proposed deputizing all of the city employees, the metro employees, having them go into restaurants and bars and places and issue citations. I have a feeling that's not going to work so well, that a lot of people will get hurt if they try to be Barney Fife and issue citations. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is, yes, the emails reveal that the mayor's office, that they were discussing how not to reveal the information that the bars and restaurants were not a major source of COVID-19 infections. Instead, it was construction sites and nursing homes. That became public. There were news stories about the mayor, calls for his resignation. The headline today is, the mayor is demanding an apology because the emails were taken out of context. And there's a reporter here named Phil Williams, who used to be our greatest investigative reporter. He broke so many stories over the years. Phil Williams has retracted his story about the COVID cover-up, saying that the emails were taken out of context. So that's the latest on Nashville and the COVID cover-up. But the mayor has used COVID-19 as a way to punish businesses he doesn't like, whose owners did not support him. Many of these people that are suffering the most were supporters of mine when I ran for mayor. And it looks like he's trying to drive them out of business. He is a developer. If they go out of business, if they lose their property, guess who benefits? Developers.
Mm. Wow. This mayor is sounding like he's a control freak, but he is really, this is an intrusion on all their civil liberties there in Nashville, is it not?
Well, he frames it as if they're trying to save lives. And Nashville is one of those cities where the abortion clinics were open and the liquor stores all during the time that they said we had this major crisis. And there is an issue about what the mayor did with over $82 million of COVID-19 money. He's trying to get a bailout from the state. The state has said no. There's money that's unaccounted for that could have been used to help the small businesses and restaurants downtown. They received only a small amount of that money, maybe $6 million of the millions and millions of dollars that Nashville has received because of COVID-19. Nashville was broke before COVID-19. Yeah. And I think that the mayor has kept it going as a way to get more federal money. But also, I think that he's keeping it going because Democrats seem to want the country locked down, shut down. They don't want anyone to enjoy their lives. So we did not have a 4th of July celebration of any type. The things that have normally taken place in Nashville have not taken place. The high schools are not meeting where the children can play sports. So many things have been done that has changed the quality of life in Nashville. But this morning, I also read an article that said that the mayor is going to be loosening some of the restrictions next week. And I'm sure the loosening of some of the restrictions has something to do with the fact that he's facing a class action suit from the bar and restaurant owners, as well as the exposure of those emails that were, quote, taken out of context.
I want to play an audio clip for you, Carol. I'd like you to respond to it that plays right into what we're talking about with Attorney General William Barr. Listen to this just a moment, please.
Putting a national lockdown, stay-at-home orders is like house arrest. Other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history. We have epidemics and pandemics. This is a very serious one, a grave one. But they come, and just because something is a medical crisis, it doesn't give a complete blank check to executive rule.
All right, you hear Attorney General William Barr there. He says putting a national lockdown, stay-at-home orders is like house arrest, other than slavery, which is different kind of restraint. This is the greatest intrusion on liberties in American history. Do you agree with that statement?
I do agree. And I have been suspicious of how coronavirus has been used from the very beginning. I published an article that I believe was also published on your platform about coronavirus politics. From the very beginning, the numbers did not add up. I think that the Democrats have always used it as a way to control the public, to incite fear. But at the end of the day, they want to take away our civil rights and civil liberties and make us more like a totalitarian society. I don't know if you've noticed that first that Bill Gates criticized the FDA and the CDC about their policies. And so that was interesting. But now the CDC has retracted its statement that healthy people don't need to get tested for coronavirus. Now they're saying if you've been in within 6 feet of anyone that might have had coronavirus, you need to get tested even if you're asymptomatic. And so I just think it's just ridiculous how the CDC has no credibility. Bill Gates comes out, makes a statement, and all of a sudden they're backtracking and backpedaling. They are clearly just pulled to and fro by politics. And then the head of the CDC, he's out there saying that vaccines may not work, but we should wear masks forever. I just think Trump should get rid of him and as many of the other people that are political appointees that are part of misleading the American people. Are they so confused that they don't know what positions to take? They're not following science, they're following whoever is pulling their strings.
Every one of these stories, politics plays a deep, deep role in, and the bureaucrats are front and center to that, Carol, which is one of my things lately I've been talking about. We need term limits for everybody. And speaking about the Supreme Court earlier, I believe we should have term limits for the Supreme Court, as well as the House and the Senate, as well as key roles in all these bureaucracies, all of these government agencies from a certain position up in the higher upper echelon of these roles should all be timed. You can only spend so much in that role. That is probably the only singular way to get rid of this swampy establishment over time. What do you think about that?
Well, it would require constitutional amendments to change the terms for the Congress as well as for the Supreme Court. I definitely believe that the time is now for us to pass a constitutional amendment for term limits for members of the Congress.
Yeah, it should be. I think it's across the board here. And the last story, Carol, to play on all of this, if people were nervous or thought, wow, there's a lot of bad information out there, or wow, we're being misled, or and this also plays into social media. In fact, one of the other things I want to tell people on is that we're seeing an unprecedented amount of well, I don't know what you want to call it. It's beyond censoring. But with Facebook and Twitter, all the social media outfits across the board now, it's really getting on steroids. With the election coming, they are locking down even ads the Trump administration is putting out and others, and they're putting that they're untrue right on it. I mean, they're clearly overstepping their bounds and have clearly become publishers, which means the rules of engagement are going to have to change. But interesting story on Twitter, their public policy chief departed to join Joe Biden's transition team. So if you had any suspect of how in the tank Twitter was for the left, and I know none of you out there probably even question that at this point, but this guy here was Carlos Monnier is his name there. And he's a former Democratic aide who served as Twitter's director of public policy. He left the social media company this week here to join Joe Biden's transition team, according to reports here, Carol. And he worked, by the way, in Barack Obama's White House, and he's worked with Hillary Clinton. But this is a guy running public policy for Twitter. What does that tell you?
Well, I mean, we already know that those social media companies are extended arms of the Democratic Party. So it doesn't surprise me one bit that one of their top executives would just publicly align himself with the party. I mean, it's full of their supporters.
Well, again, we're seeing there's a push on the media, and that's really what the point of this whole, really the program today is. It's really I call it a national media disgrace. But all these stories and all these paths lead to one conclusion, and that is that they all have outcomes that the political operatives are desire and that they are promoting and pushing. And you're seeing that in across the board here as we gear up to a very, very aggressive election season for sure. A tremendous thank you to Dr. Carol Swain. Well, up next, we're going to turn overseas to some major stories, including the peace agreement in the Middle East and much, much more. Stay right there, friends. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
The war on America's cities and claims of racism in the ranks of law enforcement have spirited a renewed debate on racial equality. It was Alexis de Tocqueville who reminded us Americans are so enamored of equality. They would rather be equal in slavery than unequal in freedom. To which I say, be warned of the shiny object, America. AmericaOutLoud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Well, it's a fight for the soul of humanity.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@AmericaOutLoud.com.
One of the biggest stories we've seen in really some time is this historic peace deal. But you wouldn't know that if you're just looking at a lot of mainstream media or networks. You wouldn't even know this thing happened. It's amazing how a story like that doesn't get the airwaves. And again, it plays to the narrative, what I've said to you right up front of the program. It is really a national media disgrace. In so many ways. There are some very important stories abroad I want to cover with you, starting with that peace deal right next year. But let me bring on first a time to the program here. Adam Credo is here, and Adam is a senior writer reporting on national security and foreign policy matters for the Washington Free Beacon, which is a great publication. And let's start with this historic peace deal now. Israel, UAE was first, Bahrain was next here, and there is talk about, well, could Saudi Arabia be in the mix here? How important is this deal, or what's your take on it?
Sure, and it's good to be with you. I appreciate you having me. So this is pretty major. I mean, the first major peace announcement in more than four decades, and it comes from countries that have been either at war with Israel or outright hostile for quite a long time. And I think that there's a lot of evidence to indicate that there will be other countries that follow suit with this. They want increased business relations with Israel. Look, over the decades, Israel has become an economic powerhouse. It's also become a military powerhouse. And those types of relationships, I think, are very appetizing for not only the Gulf Arab nations, but many of the others scattered throughout the Middle East. The only clear opposition we've really seen have been from Qatar and Iran, which both are aligned in terms of supporting and hosting terror groups around the region and all around fomenting chaos. And the backdrop, I think, of all of this that's important to note is Saudi Arabia. They lead the Gulf region and they lead the Arab world in a lot of ways. I don't think that these peace deals would have been possible without them when Israel held that historic flight immediately after the deal was announced over to the United Arab Emirates. They flew over Saudi airspace, right? So I think that's a sign to you that Saudi Arabia, while not announcing formally normalized relations, the threat of Iran has fundamentally altered the landscape of the Middle East, and these nations realize it, and this is their reaction to it.
Yeah, you just said the key right there, as far as I can see, and I've been saying that from the beginning, Adam, is that Iran, in a weird sort of way, has been a unifying force for the area. I mean, in fact, I even said when this first happened, I said, by golly, they actually had a big part of this peace deal. What do you think about that? But in kind of an odd way, they did.
Yeah, you're really right about that. I think that that piece of it should not be lost on people. This did not come out of the blue. In fact, it's pretty clear to me, and I think many others that follow the region closely, that even before these countries announced peace, there had been a significant cool down in their animosity towards Israel and the Jewish state, primarily because of Iran and what they're doing. Look, where is Iran? They've got Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah essentially runs Lebanon, and they're a threat right on Israel's northern border in the Golan Heights area. You've got Iran in Syria. You've got Iran in Yemen, where the Houthi rebels have been attacking their neighbors and attacking Saudi Arabia. And you have Iran scattered forces all throughout the region, including Iraq, where they've attacked American assets and the unified government there. So really, you can see this foothold all across the region, and the peace is a reaction to it. The Gulf Arab nations don't want it anymore. They're sick of Iran and they're sick of Qatar united together and fomenting this chaos and terrorism across the region. And they want a new day for peace. And Israel is really the linchpin to that.
Beyond historical, I mean, this is going to go down to one of his probably biggest accomplishments. But yet again, Adam, as we say, the media across the board has been so silent. And it's really sad they're not celebrating a big American achievement, but they're not clearly. Now, one group, and I want to talk about a few Congress members here that I want you to mention here. This American Muslims for Palestine, the AMP, is an anti-Israel group, and they have been promoting, like, always we hear these boycotts against the Jewish state. But there are some, what's really interesting about this, there are some members of Congress who have joined forces with this group. Who are they?
Yeah, we had quite a few. And interestingly enough, the event they held that promoted boycotts of Israel and really tried to undermine this announcement of peace by rejecting normalization. These guys did it on the same day that that peace deal was announced. So I think that tells you quite a bit about who they are and what they believe and what their actual feelings are towards peace. We had a few members of Congress join this group, AMP. You had Betty McCollum from Minnesota, Rashida Tlaib, I'm sure that's not surprising, from Michigan, Donald Payne from New Jersey, Debbie Dingell from Michigan, Andre Carson and Judy Chu, also representatives that join that. And look, these are lawmakers. I think all of them have a very prominent anti-Israel streak. I'm sure they wouldn't frame it that way, but a lot of the action they support in Congress are bills that would undermine the historic U.S.-Israel relationship. And it really is startling to see them do that on the day peace is announced. And like you said, the news media also is somewhat to blame for this, for not covering it properly. The chyron on CNN that day that the leaders of Bahrain, of Israel, of the UAE, and of course President Trump were at the White House. On that day, the chyron on CNN was White House holds large event without distancing, right? So I think that shows you just how slanted and completely outrageous the media has become on this, that's not even a semblance of neutrality in trying to deliver the news of what's happening.
Wow. I mean, Adam, that is unreal. I mean, again, you talk about a national media disgrace. I mean, they're at the top of that list, but you know, Americans need to be aware of this, and that's our job here and role, is to open up people's eyes to understand the Fourth Estate is long gone. And there are a few of us like yourself and the Washington Free Beacon, and there are many, there are some others. I mean, it's just not the mainstream and the some of these quacks out there, clearly. And they're destroying the free press is what they're doing here in this country. Listen, while we're on Iran a moment, let's move. This is interesting, this next story, which you wrote about, by the way, and this is something that worries me a great deal. And let's make people aware of the cyber scare here. It's the cyber theft of national security and nuclear information as well. Now, this story seems to me a lot bigger than, and I want you to tell me if it is or isn't, but based on what I've seen about this, this seems to be, to me, a significant story that has barely gotten any coverage around here. And here's the thing that worries me. These hacks have been going on that we're going to talk about right now since early, 2013 or something like that, mm-hmm. and include a lot of the groups, Adam, I talk about that worry me, like our universities. You mentioned here an unnamed D.C.-based think tank, a defense contractor, an aerospace company, and many other types of organizations. Tell us what's behind this and what's happened here.
Sure. Well, I think your gut is correct. This is a really big story, and it didn't get tons of ink, and I'm even somewhat guilty of that in some respects. I only wrote a couple hundred words of about it. I didn't really have the bandwidth to dig in too far, but this is emblematic of something Iran is doing for a while, which is trying to hack essentially everybody they can in the United States, including the government. In this particular case, there were two hackers. There are probably more, but two were named in the indictment. And you're right, since about 2013, they had been conducting hacks on behalf of Iran, that is to steal information from the academic institutions in America, that's colleges, and that would include research, even proprietary research, aerospace data, that's stuff on our airplanes, how they fly, what they can do. The national security front, like you said, the nuclear information, but non-military, which is interesting because I don't think they were able to penetrate the really well-protected government computers in that field. But still, again, even scientific nuclear information helps them march closer to a weapon by, you know, perfecting the know-how that it takes to get there. But perhaps most interesting, or at least to me most interesting, they were focusing quite a bit on information about human rights activists and those in the Iranian dissident community. This is massive for Iran. There was another case just last year, a couple of fellows who were arrested in California, and they were spying on behalf of Iran. We found that they had ties to their Ministry of Intelligence over there. And they were scoping out Jewish sites, Jewish institutes, different places they could potentially launch an attack, right? So this is something that Tehran is focused very closely on, not just scoping out locations where they could potentially attack us, but also trying to get that information about those who oppose the regime so they can either assassinate them, which we know they do, or try to arrest them when they're traveling, or all around just keep tabs on these people. And I think that's really the scary part here. But more broadly on the hack, just to mention kind of the details, this is hundreds of terabytes of data, yeah, which is almost impossible to imagine that quantity. And some of it they sold, some of it they gave back to the Iranian government. But I can't think of a similar hack where just so much raw data was stolen.
Yeah, this is massive. And you're saying the terabytes that were, I mean, this is a massive, massive operation here, and yet I've heard barely nothing about it. And I applaud you for putting it out there and writing about it. I mean, how many wouldn't have even known about it without you saying that? But listen, sure. Adam, I think the cyber theft, and more so even on our end, cybersecurity, is probably our biggest threat to national security. And I've been worried about this for years, but I think this is our biggest threat more than anything else. What do you say to that?
Yeah, without a doubt, I actually tend to agree with you. Numerous government reports that I've read over the years always kind of raise the alarm about the weakness of our defenses. That is, in terms of the banking sector, they're vulnerable to hackers. You know, this isn't just individuals, but the government is as well. I'm sure you'll remember the OPM hacks, and the State Department has admitted that hundreds and hundreds of hack attempts are made each day. The White House has admitted similar things. And look, it's not just Iran, it's enemies like Russia, it's enemies like China, who are in some ways even more sophisticated in the way that they attack us. And the U.S. is always kind of off of foot. We're always reacting to these types of attacks. And that's what I find particularly startling. And you see the same thing in Congress. There have been multiple hack attacks. There have been staffers who have been arrested and indicted for stealing data from congressional computers. So this is something that's taking place all the time, and it's a big focus for adversarial regimes because it's the easiest way for them to get sensitive information on the internet.
You just said the key right there. We are being too reactive and not proactive, and that's what I want listeners to take away from this. This is a major concern, and it for a lot of reasons. And it's actually the story that worries me the most, because I'm afraid one day we're going to wake up and we're going to find that our major infrastructure and or military parts or even things we count on have been hacked and are no longer accessible or available to us. I think on all levels, this is one of the biggest challenges moving ahead in the future that's going to be our undoing. We've got to be careful of this for sure. And, you know, we get the hacks here as well, Adam. We get them on all levels. We have technology meetings. Then you have to have a roving IP. You have to be like three steps ahead of the bad guys. You know what I mean? It's constant.
You really do. You really do. I mean, it's important to take those precautions, not just as individuals, but you would think the government is doing that. Yeah. And I think that people would be kind of worried to find that they're not doing as much as we think they might should be doing. Like I said, it's very reactive, and it's not just the Iranians, and it's not just the Russians or the Chinese, but all bad actors really across the world. And let us all remember, this isn't just information, right, that they're stealing. Our critical services, electricity, telephone lines, all of these are connected to the internet and vulnerable to the hackers.
Yeah, absolutely. And that just changes the rules entirely here moving forward. And we're living in a technological world. I mean, we count on all of this stuff. So anyways, all right. So there's one last story briefly I want to cover with you in the last couple moments here. That's this very interesting. You wrote about this U.S. think tank that is under fire for hosting top Iranian official. And what gets me about this is that clearly this is against the laws. It's against U.S. sanction laws. And it no matter what, I mean, I think if you look at that, there are heavy sanctions in place here, and they are obviously violating the rules. But this is where they're hosting Zarif, the foreign minister, I believe. What's going on with this one?
Yeah, you're right. A pretty well-known think tank in town, the Council on Foreign Relations, they have tons of former government officials from both sides of the aisle. They're nonpartisan, and they're very prominent. And they're scheduled to host next week, next Thursday, I believe, Javad Zarif. He is the Iranian foreign minister. He helped formulate that nuclear deal that the Obama administration signed. And since the Trump administration came into office, they've actually issued sanctions on senior Iranian officials like Zarif. So they're specially designated nationals is what the formal term is for them. And that does actually, by the letter of the law, make it illegal for a group like CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, and Zoom, by the way, which is hosting the meeting, to bring Zarif aboard. You cannot provide material support and services, including technological services, to designated individuals. Now, aside from that letter of the law stuff, there's something else going on here. The invitation to Zarif was extended just several days after they tortured and then they murdered an Iranian wrestler for attending a peaceful protest. There was global pressure for them to not do this, and yet they did it anyway, because this is what that regime does. They torture dissidents, they imprison them, and they kill them. They do it to homosexuals, they do it to Jewish people, they do it to all types of minorities and what they call non-believers. So I think this really shows to the readers, and hopefully people who are able to pay attention to this article, how tone deaf these Washington think tanks are. You're not interviewing Zarif in a bubble. There are global implications to these types of events, and to make pretend that he is a serious government official and not a representative of a murdering tyrannical regime, I think is just the wrong view here. And many people have pointed it out. CFR, by the way, got deluged with email, not just from the general public, but their own members, who said, don't do this, don't hold this event. It sends the wrong signal, and they chose to disregard that. They're going to go forward with it. So I think it's a very bold decision on their part.
Yeah, we'll see what becomes of it very clearly. And, you know, when it comes to human rights, countries like this, they don't value human life, clearly. I speak about that all the time, and that's a problem we have with China as well and so many others out there. They look at human life differently than what we do here in the U.S., for sure here. Let me bring on here Steve Genizak here. He calls himself the Millennial Conservative. He's an organizer of a petition. But Steve, let me get right to the story of what happened at this ceremony, what had taken place. There's a lot of really weird pieces about this with Mayor Kirk Peluso here. If you would tell us what was happening at the ceremony.
Okay, basically, we had a small gathering to remember what took place on 9/11. Unfortunately, we lost three citizens from this town on that horrible day. And so we got together to have the ceremony. There was, we had a police honor guard, like the color guard, who was going to present the colors. And each one of them was going to wear a face mask with the American flag with a thin blue line on it. So what happened was, and this comes directly from one of my close friends who was on the color guard that day. He stated that the police chief came over and told them they weren't allowed to wear those face masks while being in the ceremony. And the directive came directly from the mayor, because the mayor had explained to the police chief that it was a political statement. And as a result, they weren't allowed to wear those masks.
Which was outrageous, clearly. I mean, that they can't even, put their beliefs on whatever they wear. And you're being told now what to wear and what to do. So what happened? What did you do? You organized a petition?
Correct. I got together with a bunch of friends from town. You know, word got out about what took place, and people were really upset. So we figured, how can we try to show our discontent with what took place and try in a way to hold the mayor and the council accountable? Because it wasn't just the mayor. No one on the council spoke up about it either. And so I started a petition at change.org. Mm-hmm. And basically it's up to, we have 1,027 signatures from all around the country, showing support for, holding the council accountable for what they did. Okay. And we intend to present this petition at the upcoming council meeting, so it becomes part of the public record. So that way it's on record what took place on that day, and the fact that the citizens were not happy with how it all played out.
Now, Steve, what's the goal? How many signatures you want, or does it really matter?
I honestly just wanted to see how far we could get it to go. And, with the petition and with the outreach that we've done trying to make this story known, right, it garnered some national media attention. And, people are waking up and realizing that, a lot of the Democrats, not just in our own town, but Democrats as a whole, there's an attack. They're going after our police. The whole defund the police movement and all those types of things taking place right now, it's coming to a hyper local level. Mm-hmm. And unless we speak up and we start, exposing what's going on, who knows where it's going to go.
There is no doubt that about all Americans know that our law enforcement, they are under attack every moment of the day. And there's a lot of problems with that. But let me just tell folks as well, Police Chief Glenn Caldwell. So he said this, in his response to all of this, he said, the thin blue line is a tribute to all fallen police officers, including those lost on 9/11. He said to interpret it otherwise would be hollow-hearted. This is where we stand. Well, that's simple enough to me, Steve.
Oh, yeah. It's very straightforward. And I also think about the idea that, they give credence to all these different organizations. I often wonder if those guys that were in the ceremony that day, if they had Black Lives Matter masks on, would the mayor and council have told them to remove those masks as well? Or was it just because, you know, they wanted them to remove the thin blue line masks because they didn't like them because they thought it was a political statement? So it's such a, there's a double standard at play here too. And I also say that because, you know, our mayor and council, we had Black Lives Matter protests in our own town throughout the summer. And our mayor and council showed up at just about every single one of those protests, but they can't stand behind our police force at the same time. But essentially what we're looking for, a written apology for what took place during the 9/11 ceremony.
That's right.
And we would also like to see, maybe they could condemn Black Lives Matter and the fact that they have become a Marxist movement, and they could show solidarity with our police force by condemning the Black Lives Matter people.
Well, I don't know that you'll get part two of that request, but you might get part one if you're lucky. But the mayor now, the mayor is Kurt Peluso, is it?
Correct.
Yeah.
And I will say, I will preface this with the fact that, you know, I deep down, I really do think he's a good guy. I really, really do think he's
a good guy. Then why is he doing this? Why is he doing it?
But I think that we have there's other voices on the council. Our council in town is a full Democrat council. So I think that he's being pulled by the other people on the council to move a certain way. And he put himself between a rock and a hard place, where it's either go along with the radical Democrats on the council or side with the police and show support for the police.
Well, it's a problem we're having in a lot of local politics, Steve, is they got a lot of these little Marxist mayors and Marxist city council people and who want to control lives, basically. And we're seeing that all across the nation now. It's really shines out here. And let's talk about New Jersey, the governor. I see stories now in the last many days, he's raising the millionaire's tax. And this is quite a story because this is, again, Governor Phil Murphy we're speaking about. So he's going to go ahead, and this is as bad as de Blasio at this point. He's raising it from 8.97 to 10.75, and people are suggesting he's going to push all the wealthy people, or people who pay a lot of taxes, out of the state entirely. That is the risk of this move, and there are reports that he's been trying to do this since he's been in office. Steve, what do you say about this?
Yeah, he's just like de Blasio, like you said. He's been pushing taxes up one side, down the other. And they always have that idea of, you know, demonizing the rich. And that's what he's doing now. And I think they're using the COVID crisis as a means to push this tax, because from what I've seen in the state house, you know, a lot of the assembly people and the state senators, they feel there's no other option now. So they're kind of just going along with it. And the concern, like you said, is if we start taxing all of the rich people, that's quote unquote rich, because $1 million in New Jersey isn't even really all that rich now. If they start taxing all these millionaires, they have the means to leave. And when they leave, who's left to foot the tax bill when the millionaires left? The middle class people who are barely getting by in this state that's just being run into the ground.
This scenario cannot play out well, no matter how you look at it here. But you're seeing this in so many cities. And remember, a lot of these blue cities and blue states have been underhandedly ruled for some time. They're upside down backwards in their budgets, is what I'm suggesting, which is why the Speaker of the House, Pelosi, is trying to push another several trillion dollars through the cash drawer of the United States Treasury, and the taxpayer, you out there, is to undo all those bad policies they've been putting out there for many years. Basically, I would suggest to you, it's a bit of a cover up. And that's what you're seeing play out right now under the guise of a pandemic. Well, we call this pandemic politics for sure here. Big thank you to Steve Jenziak there. And so, again, the whole narrative here is a national media disgrace. We're not getting the information we need, people. And I think you've got one thing to blame here beside bad politics. Is you got a dysfunctional, they've gone rogue, and I'm talking about the Fourth Estate, the media at large. So, well, let me tell you what we get coming up in the next hour with Michael Johns on Viewpoint Presents. We'll get more into the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, historical move here, what will happen next, of course. We'll talk more about the DOJ, Attorney General William Barr, the Durham probe. What's going on since the Durham probe? Where's that at? And people are wondering what's going to happen. We thought that would be happening at least by Labor Day. Still don't have that. Very interesting hour coming up next for you, friends. Thank you again for being with me on the journey here, as always. It's time to get involved and get loud.